Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Windows Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott, episode 167, recorded July 29th, 2010. Childlike Wonder. This episode of Windows Weekly is brought to you by Ford and voice-activated Sync, featuring true hands-free calling, turn-by-turn directions, 911 assist, and more. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com, and be sure to listen to TWiT all this week for updates on innovations at Maker Faire at the Ford Museum in Detroit, featuring inventions from 300 makers. And by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account, go to squarespace.com/windows. And by audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/windows. It's time for Windows Weekly, the show that covers everything Windows, with Paul Thurrott, news editor for Windows IT Pro, the man in charge of winsupersite.com, and the author of Windows Phone Secrets. Nice to meet you, Paul.
Nice to meet you as well.
Yeah, this is...
I have two personal questions to ask.
Absolutely.
Because we've never met.
Ask away.
I see you occasionally before my podcast because Leo will run these pre-recorded shows, right?
Right.
On the live feed, and sometimes it's your new show. So the questions I have for you are, one, does Leo call you number two?
Hasn't yet. Well, unless you mean pejoratively, but no.
No.
He hasn't yet.
Okay. I would demand that of him.
I think so. And, yeah, I like that.
Yeah. And every time I hear your name, I think of a character on the newer version of Battlestar Galactica.
Which one?
The Richard Hatch character. What was his name on the show? Do you have any idea?
Oh, yeah.
Very close to Tom Merritt.
I get the character from Demon a lot, Daniel Suarez novel, because his name's Roy Merritt, I think, the
yes,
Burning
yes,
Man.
Yes, yes, yes. So yeah.
Well, what is Hatch's name? It's like Merrick.
It's something very similar. And in fact, I think it's Tom whatever.
I'm dancing around waiting for the chat room to come up with it.
I know.
Because they know everything. Someone's Googling it right now for us, I'm sure. Tom Zarek.
Zarek.
There we go. Thank you, GoHawk09.
I don't know what it is. Every time I see the name, I think Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah. Well, it's onomatopoeia.
Yeah.
There's a certain similarity there.
Yeah.
Every time I hear your name, I think Windows because I've followed your work for years. So
okay.
I hate to typecast you like that, but
no, it's okay. I'm growing. I understand it. I don't love it, but I get it.
Our first big story today is Microsoft quarterly revenues being a record. And a lot of people were debating this around the idea of who's bigger, Apple or Microsoft. Is that the headline here, or is there better stuff to talk about?
Well, I mean, we've had this discussion before, Leo and I. You know, Apple and Microsoft obviously compete in certain markets, so it's natural for people to want to make that comparison. And let's face it, as far as the PC industry went, obviously Microsoft beat up on Apple pretty bad for a long time there. So I think there's a nice little bit of schadenfreude here that, you know, Apple is able to overtake Microsoft from a market share cap perspective, right? Although in some ways that's semi-artificial, but, you know, they're both ginormous companies. I think that's the important thing there. I think for this quarter in particular, a lot of people were looking for Apple to surpass Microsoft from a revenues perspective, which didn't happen, although only barely so. Microsoft continues to make a lot more in the way of earnings or profits than Apple does, primarily because they're a software company and not a hardware company. I think that's the big difference there. But Microsoft did report record revenues for the quarter, which I think surprised some people. They also capped off their fiscal year on kind of a high note. And I think a lot of the comparisons you can make year over year are very interesting. But I think the big one for Microsoft is just when you look at it, you realize, you know, a year ago, Microsoft was selling Windows Vista. And this year they're selling Windows 7 and maybe as important also Office 2010. You know, so it was kind of a big quarter for those guys.
And does this help put to rest some of the unsettling debates that were happening about, oh, maybe Steve Ballmer should go and let's clear out the old wood. And, you know, it's not the company that Bill Gates started, all that stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. Yeah. I mean, no, that's a reasonable debate. You know, Microsoft posted some figures a few weeks ago. I'm sure you guys talked about that on the news show. Frank Shaw, one of their PR heads. And there was a lot of implicit stuff in there, right? He didn't explicitly ever say, this is why this number is important. And also, they left out certain numbers that maybe weren't so generous to the company. But one of the implicit signals in those figures was, here were our revenues when Steve Ballmer took over the reins of CEO 10 years ago, and here's what they are today. Look how much bigger we are as a company. So that is one way to look at it, definitely one way to look at it. But, you know, inevitably, and Apple falls into this comparison very neatly, when you track how this company has done over the past 10 years, one of the things you also see is their stock price and how it has basically hung unchanged, you know, or relatively unchanged over this entire period. Whereas
it's Apple's, reliable. It's always the same amount.
Yes, that's an interesting way to put it. It is reliable, and Microsoft customers do like reliability.
That's right,
and predictability. So yeah, I guess if you're looking for boring and unchanging, Microsoft was a great company over the past 10 years. But you know, from a stock price perspective, Apple's stock, of course, has skyrocketed, and maybe by a factor of 10 or higher. I think I know that now they're probably in the 260s or something. Microsoft is in the 26s. You know, it's a vastly different thing, and it explains why the market cap for the two companies is so has changed hands. Essentially, the positions have changed hands. You know, Apple is a company that grows very, very fast, and Microsoft is a company, like you said, that is very reliable. I guess
right. You're not going to make a lot of money on their stock necessarily.
Yeah, but, not on the stock.
When's the last time they split?
Actually, they do split the stock fairly regularly. In fact, I want to say they've done it at least once in the past 12 months.
Okay.
They are pretty good about that kind of stuff. And I think that, you know, I think they have to be, right, to just retain whatever investors they have and so forth. But yeah, the stock price is not a strength of Microsoft. But what Microsoft does have are some pretty, again, reliable businesses. And I think a lot of people, I don't have the numbers right here in front of me, but I think a lot of people, when they think of Microsoft, they think Windows Office and they think that's most of it or whatever. But, you know, even in this most recent quarter, the business that generated the most revenues was, in fact, Office, the one that's responsible for Office, the business division. And close behind it was Windows. But actually not too far behind that was the server and tools, basically Windows Server. And those are traditional software markets, but they also do represent the bulk of Microsoft's earnings. So I think a lot of people think of Microsoft as a two-product company in many ways. I think it's more reasonable to suggest that they're a kind of a three-product company, I guess, if you will, Server, Office, and Windows, you know, on the client.
And Windows is saving their bacon, right? I mean, it's selling like hotcakes.
Yeah, big time. Big time, yeah. I made a comparison about this in a news article I wrote. You know, people try to disparage these figures a little bit because they say, well, look, you know, Windows ships on every PC. I mean, how else could it be other than a huge bestseller? You know, Microsoft talks about how they've sold 175 million copies. They provided the figure that breaks down to 10 units sold every second. It's almost 1 million units sold every single day, you know, so presumably over the next year, they could sell over the course of a year, could sell somewhere in the 350 million units sold range, which is unbelievable. But, you know, again, looking back a year ago to when Windows Vista was on the market, Windows Vista wasn't selling on every single PC that was going out the door. So it's not enough to be bundled with PCs. You know, obviously in that case, most PC makers or many PC makers were selling Windows XP instead of the newest version of the OS at the time. This time, Windows 7 is perceived as being a superior product to its predecessor. So now they're selling a lot of the new one, which is great. But I think that's the difference. You know, it's not just that they're bundling it on PCs, which is fantastic. It's that they're bundling it and people want the new one. You know, they don't want the old one. So there is a there is also a perception difference this time around that's working in their favor as well.
Yeah, it seems like Microsoft's huge advantage that they still have over anyone else who wants to compete with them is the enterprise. They are the choice for the enterprise. Every once in a while you hear somebody like, oh, maybe they're going to go to Google Apps for the domain, or maybe they're going to experiment with Mac. Yeah. But everyone else buys Windows. The big negative for them was that everyone stayed on XP. They just didn't move to Vista.
Right.
Now, are we seeing people moving to Windows 7 more? It seems like we are.
Yeah, it seems like we are. I want to be very careful about that because that's something I write for Windows IT Pro magazine, and that's something that we track very closely. And one of the things we saw with Windows Vista was a very reliable trend in the early days where corporations started to talk about wanting to upgrade. They talked about plans for deploying. They talked about evaluating the system. At some point, the talk changed to, as it always did in the past, well, we're going to wait for Service Pack 1. And then Service Pack 1 shipped, and it didn't change at all. I think somehow by that point, there was this kind of weird, bad vibe around Vista, and it just wasn't. All the talk that had occurred before stopped, and the actual deployments never really happened, not in the way that they had in the past. So, you know, as you said, over the intervening years, lots and lots of XP. Now, it's early on with Windows 7 still, and it's weird for me because I guess, I don't want to say I want, but I sort of want to believe that people are being honest about what they're doing deployment-wise. But right now, it's the same as it was in the beginning of Windows Vista's timeframe, which is a lot of talk, some evaluations, some actual deployments, right? And I think the only difference is we are seeing some companies who had waited for so long on XP are finally, tipping the scales and going with Windows 7. But it's still very early on. I expect the corporate adoption of Windows 7 to still be relatively slow, given how long these companies have stayed on XP. It's really kind of astonishing. But I guess what I'm trying to say is I think and I sort of hope that it's happening. But right now, I think it's still a little early to say.
Well, Windows 7 has a couple things to deal with that Vista didn't as much, which is which is the economy. I mean, when I say a couple things, that's one.
Yeah.
You know, nobody wants. Everyone's even less willing to spend money now than they were back then.
Absolutely. I mean, corporations as a whole, any size business, from small business up to the biggest enterprise, are notoriously cheap when it comes to spending money on technology, upgrading computers. That's been a huge trend over the past many years, over the past decade, where companies have been stretching out their technology investments, causing Microsoft to extend their support licenses or support agreements with customers on ever longer basis, because companies expect these things to run longer and longer. And then you hit that economy and the recession or depression or whatever you want to call it. And I mean, everything just came to a screeching halt right there. So yeah, I mean, some encouraging signs, but it's hard to know whether is it Windows 7? Is it just natural pickup after this economic recovery starts kicking in, or is it nothing at all? You know, we don't know yet. It's just early days.
All right, let's move off the ledger, and in a second, I want to talk a little bit more about Windows Phone. I know you guys talked about it a lot last week on Windows Weekly, but I also want to explain to people why Leo isn't here. Leo is actually on his way to Detroit, and you may ask, why is he going to Detroit? You know, he's going to Detroit for several reasons. There's a Detroit Maker Faire going on there, but he's also going to be visiting the Ford Museum in Detroit. And of course, this episode is brought to you by Ford and Voice Activated Sync. It's the in-car communication and connectivity system that Leo uses every day. If he could have, I bet he would have driven to Detroit if he was closer to Detroit. True hands-free calling, turn-by-turn voice directions, 911 assist, voice activated music and podcast browsing. You get all of that personalized traffic and a lot more. And you can do all this while you're keeping your eyes on the road. That's the thing. Instead of watching that person weave around in front of you while they're on the phone and trying to figure out how to get around them and pass them before they cause havoc, you've got somebody who keeps their eyes on the road, drives in a straight line, and can still do all of the stuff we were talking about. Maker Faire is this weekend at the Henry Ford Museum in Detroit. Leo's going to be there. He's going to have a Twit Live Saturday, July 31st. He's also going to be doing a meetup there. So check it out. He's really excited. I mean, we had a big meeting yesterday afternoon. All the stuff that he's going to do. He's going to get to do maybe, I don't know if I'm supposed to say or not, but maybe a little test drive. We'll keep that under wraps as far as the other details. But we thank support for their support for Innovation, Maker Faire, and for Windows Weekly. Let's move on to Windows Phone. So you were pretty excited about it last week. Still excited?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, you know, it's tricky because I'm working on a book right now about Windows Phone, and I have the shortest imaginable schedule, you know, no time at all to get this thing done. And it's been hard because it's been a lot of very, very late nights and really trying to thoroughly document this thing. And it's not, I wish I had more time in a way, but I understand the need of the, you know, the publishing company to get it out on time. But the one thing that strikes me about Windows, not the one thing. There are a number of things that strike me about Windows Phone. I mean, I will say that for me personally, I'm a tech enthusiast. I love technology, obviously. I've never run into anything on Windows Phone that's made me doubt that this is something, you know, truly innovative and exciting and interesting. And I really like the way it works and looks, and I love the different UIs they've created, especially around these, you know, panoramic hubs and so forth. It's just a nicely thought out system. But in the process of documenting this thing, I mean, it's been shocking in some ways to me how predictable it has become, that for every incredible feature on this phone, there are a handful of little missing pieces, you know, that I really feel very strongly people need to understand up front, because I know out in the world, on the internet, in the blogosphere, whatever, there are people who are very excited about Windows Phone and can't wait to get their hands on it and all this. I've got people emailing me every single day, you know, my contract is expiring, should I wait for Windows Phone? And I feel a responsibility to make sure that people understand what they're getting into, you know, that it is awesome, you know, from a broad strokes thing. But if you're a very technical person, I think you're gonna take issue with some of these missing features. And I think it's the stuff you need to understand. I think for the broad consumer base, that Windows Phone is an incredible solution. And I think from day one, it's going to be perfectly fine, you know, for 90-whatever% of the world. But for those, you know, 5% of us or whatever, you know, that consider ourselves power users, I mean,
you talk about the omission of cut and paste and those sorts of things.
Well, actually, cut and paste is a pretty big issue. I'm talking about even smaller things. You know, it's the type of stuff you don't even really understand is missing until you use it, and it's the type of thing that Microsoft would never communicate because it just, you know, it just doesn't make sense to do it. But if you think, for example, like what type of smartphone do you use?
I carry an iPhone 4 right now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you've been an iPhone user all along, or whatever,
since
or
the Motorola Razr.
Okay. So then you may appreciate or may recall that when the original iPhone came out, the very first one, with this awesome calendar application and so forth, unless you were on a very limited subset of available calendar services, and I think it literally was Mobile Me, maybe, you couldn't do things like multiple calendars. You know, I think it was the case like with Google Calendar, you could get Google Calendar on there, but it was only your default calendar. And that, I don't recall the exact history of this, but at some point that changed and they opened it up to sub-calendars. You could do all the, maybe it was Exchange Active Sync support or whatever it was.
It was Exchange Active Sync when I actually started using the calendar. I just didn't even use it before then because it was virtually
maybe
useless.
For this reason and for other reasons, yeah. Okay. So unfortunately for Windows Phone, in the case of the calendar, which is awesome and supports Exchange Active Sync, it does multiple accounts of multiple account types. You could have two Gmail accounts on there. You know, two Hotmail accounts, two Exchange accounts, or more, you know, of each, whatever, it doesn't matter. For each of those account types I just described, you could have email, calendar, and or contact syncing, your choice, through any of those accounts. But in the calendar application specifically, which is an excellent little application, only works with the default calendar in every single case. So if you've set up multiple calendars, as many people did, and as I did before I moved to the iPhone on Google Calendar, I had multiple calendars. All of a sudden, you know, you can't access that stuff. If you have calendar subscriptions, you know, through iCal, they don't show up on the phone. And there's no way manually on the phone to add such a calendar to the calendar application, you know. So it's this beautiful thing. And it works with multiple accounts. But it's like you dig down a little bit under the surface. And then there's this kind of showstopper almost, you know, depending on your needs.
Which is funny because that's one of the big advantages that I heard you talking about with Windows Phone 7 is that it does everything else so well that you don't even think about it. All your photos are together, all of your music and all of that stuff. You'd think the calendar would be an obvious one.
Yeah. Well, but it's But these things, unfortunately, exist, you know, throughout. I mean, they're, these little issues are everywhere. And this is the thing I'm talking about. And I don't mean to cast any doubts on the capabilities here. I still feel that Windows Phone is incredible. But I, for people listening to this podcast especially, I want them to understand, you know, that there are just things missing. And you can look at any component in this whole thing and you could pick apart little things. You know, for example, it has one of the account types it supports, which is kind of interesting, is Facebook. Facebook is not configurable in any way, shape, or form. It's either on or it's off. If it's on, you get all of your Facebook contacts in the People Hub. You get your Facebook feed information in the People Hub and in the Pictures Hub. Pictures that people post to Facebook that are your friends go in the Pictures Hub and so forth. There's no way to configure it. You can't have part of that on, part of it off, whatever. And the problem with that is, you know, depending on how you use Facebook, I mean, you might not want, you might want your feed stuff so you can see what's going on with your friends, but you might not want your contacts to all be in your contacts database, right? In my case, I've got 1,500, you know, friends with air quotes around them on Facebook. Facebook is unusable for me on Windows Phone for that reason. I don't want those people in my contacts list.
This is a common problem on all kinds of devices and platforms that people are different dealing with differently. For instance, I have the Tech News Today email address. I just added it to my phone, and now it goes into the all inbox, and there's no way to stop it. Every email account you want to put on the phone goes into the all inbox. I don't want that one in the all inbox because it gets so much mail. And so I can't tell when I've got new mail because it's always going to say I have unread mail. So then calendars are like that. I mean, they've been that way forever, trying to figure out how do I sync my Yahoo calendar to my Palm Pilot, you know, to today, where it's like, well, I've got a GCal and I've got multiple versions of it. And how do I, you know, that's something that people need to fix. And maybe Microsoft's smart and saying, you know what, we're not going to try to fix that with this. We're just going to try to make it work.
You know, that's more gracious than I'm willing to be. I think that it's more of a time element, and I think they will fix it. I mean, I think in the case of calendar specifically, there's absolutely no reason why you can't, through some interface, check off the ones you want and don't want. I mean,
it seems simple enough, right?
Yeah, and other people do it, you know. I think, you know, the hardest thing for me to accept about the phone as it is, and I fully expect this to change over time. In fact, it wouldn't shock me if this changed literally the day that this thing launched, is when you plug it into your computer, it doesn't do anything other than interact with the Zune software. You can't use your standard image acquisition software, whatever that might be on Windows or the Mac, to download photos from the phone as you can with an iPhone or any other digital camera or any other smartphone. You can't access it like a hard drive. That means you can't plug it into an Xbox 360 and play content off of it over your HD TV like you can with a Zune HD or, by the way, an iPhone. It's curiously limited. I don't mind the fact that it requires Zune software to do media sync, right? That's what Apple does with iTunes. But Apple doesn't require you to use iTunes to download photos off of the phone's camera. I mean, imagine how limiting that would be, you know? Especially if they didn't give you a way to, say, put them into certain folders, folders that were based on maybe the events, that were based maybe on dates, you know, that had names that made sense, not names like WP_00001, you know, whatever.
I'm always frustrated that the iPhone isn't a mountable drive the way the iPod is for getting things like music off. So, you know, this is again, it's... I want to put this question to you. If I understand the theory of Microsoft saying, "Well, we're gonna work on making certain things really good so that we can get this out fast, and we're gonna take a little page from Apple's book, and we'll add features as we go along." I get that, but are they too far behind the eight ball now to catch up? Because that seems to be the thing that's holding back Zune, which is a fantastic music player. And a fantastic media player, but people have moved on from media players now. Are they going to say, well, yeah, Windows Phone 7, that's a fantastic phone, but there's so many other fantastic phones now, it's too limited for me.
So this is like, you know, we're already always fighting the last war kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
I think that Windows Phone has a huge chance. And I think the thing that we need to remind ourselves, as well as the people who are listening to this, is that in our world, which is sort of insular and small when you think about it.
Sure, yeah.
It is easy for us to, as I just did, to pick apart certain things But what we need to understand is that for the average consumer base, you know, that 97% of the world or more, none of these issues mean anything. And I think that the overwhelming strengths of Windows Phone, those things that they did get right, are going to blow people away if they're presented to them properly. You know, for example, it's one thing, you know, when you see Windows Phone, it's really cool. But when you see Windows Cool, when you see Windows Phone lit up with your own data, it is amazing. And that's the thing. I mean, all of these little kind of picayune complaints kind of fade away to nothing when, you know, all you do is log on with your Live ID and all of your contacts, all of your mail, all of your calendar, all your photos. You know, all this stuff is just there animating. And you see like, oh, there's my friend in that little box. And there's one of my favorite pictures right there. And, you know, it's amazing, you know. I don't know how you communicate that to people effectively because, of course, in the store, these things are just going to be sitting there, you know, and you know how store displays go.
Yeah, if they're even on at all or hooked up.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like the security line is tethered to nothing, you know, or whatever. And I guess that's my big fear. But I think that a lot of this stuff, the reason I communicate this stuff is because I think the people who read my stuff, the people who listen to this are on the more technical side of the scale. And this is going to be a concern for them. But I think, like I said, I don't know that we represent the majority. And I think for most people, when they see this stuff, it's going to be really, really exciting. I mean, even for me, grown very accustomed to a very vast app infrastructure that's available on the iPhone. And you go to this phone and you're basically, during the beta here, stuck with whatever is on the phone. You can't really download any meaningful applications yet. You can't download any games yet. So you're just kind of stuck with the stock phone. And even still, I find no desire to go back to the iPhone at all, none at all. It's still, even out of the box, amazing how much it does. I happened to be, like I said, because of the iPhone years ago, I actually cut down to one calendar and never went back. So actually, in my case, it's fine. You know, I only have one calendar, right, so that actually works out fine for me.
You've adapted to the conditions of our limited world,
That's a happy circumstance, but I do recognize that for many people, you know, people have different calendars. Even my wife has different calendars. I mean, she's not technical in the slightest. So I know this is going to be an issue for people. I think it's important to communicate that, but, I think more important for the wider world is, I think people are going to see this and they're going to be really excited by it. And that has not faded for me. And it, as overtired as I am and as hard as I've been working to get this stupid book done, I haven't lost it. I mean, I really feel like there's something special going on here. It's a neat, neat product.
That's the biggest testament you could give. I don't know if everyone in the audience necessarily understands that, but the amount of time you have to spend with something to write a book about it, the amount of headache and hours that you're just laboring over it. It's incredible.
This is not like making minimum wage. It's like paying someone else.
Yeah.
You know, I've lost money on this, but you know, you have these bitter moments, you know, in this case, you know, I had this, you dream about the book, you know, you dream about the, you know, like you can't think of anything else. I woke up one night at 3 o'clock in the morning and just worked for 2 hours because I couldn't sleep. I was so, you know,
The ideas are in your head there. You don't want to lose them.
Yeah. Right. I'm awake. Let's just get this thing done. And then, but you have these bitter moments where you think, you know, Microsoft in this case, agreed to do this book because they were going to, you know, show up with a device pretty early on and give me a lot of support. And, you know, I can't say that they've actively worked to undermine me, but they haven't exactly been great showing up for me in many ways. I didn't get a device until very late in the game. And, you know, more than a month later than I was originally told I would get it. It would have made a huge difference in my life if I could have had some kind, you know, the kind of support I expected to get from these guys. So, you know, you have this sort of bitter moment where you're like, you know, I'm going to finish this book and I'm going to go buy an Android phone or something. Screw them, you know. But then the thing is, I really like it. I like it anyway. Well, I mean, it makes sense for me, the kind of the Windows guy. You know, I should be writing about this and I should be conversant in it and have one and understand it. And so I kind of get that. It's almost a responsibility. But the truth is, this is the one that I want. So it doesn't matter for me. I mean, it's great and it's a happy coincidence, but I really love the thing.
Now, Windows Phone 7, of course, is Microsoft's bid to kind of rejuvenate their entries into the phone world. they've also got another industry that they've been in for a long time that they're trying to rejuvenate, and that's tablets. In fact, they like to think that they started this industry, and now it's passing them by. And so we heard that, you know, the Slate PC at CES, it was a big deal, and everyone was really excited, and then HP bought Palm, and there was all the scuttlebutt, they're not going to do a Windows Slate PC. But now it turns out it's back. What's the deal with this?
I've done everything I can to ignore this story. Everything. People ask me about it and ask me about it and ask me about it, and it drives me crazy. And, you know, in January, before we knew what the iPad was, Microsoft talked up Slate PCs at CES because they knew it was coming, you know, specifically an HP Slate PC. And HP has some, and still does, have some promotional materials up on their site about this Slate PC that had supposedly been in development for 5 years. Of course, then they bought Palm, right, and got WebOS. And then there was a lot of silence about the Slate PC. And there were a lot of stories about how HP was getting rid of the Slate PC, although I think I would point out to people, with the understanding I don't really want to talk about this, but I, you know, if I had been asked, I would have said HP never said they weren't making the Slate PC. I'm not sure, you know, let's see what they say before we assume what they're going to do. And then very recently, for whatever reason, HP has started talking about it again. Apparently they are coming out with a Windows 7-based Slate PC. This caused me to go back and look at the transcript from the CES speech where Steve Ballmer talked about these PCs. And to my horror, I discovered that he referred to the Slate as a new form factor. You know, I mean, Microsoft showed off a Slate PC at CES in 2001.
Yeah, I remember that.
In fact, I have the photos of it. I was there.
It was a little thicker then, but it was basically the same.
Yeah. And, you know, Microsoft's partners shipped these things in 2002. The thing that's interesting about this, when you look back at it historically, aside from the fact that it happened and we all now apparently forget that it happened, is Microsoft's partners and customers all decided that the Slate PC form factor was not efficient. And one of their partners, I think it was Acer, came up with something called a convertible PC design. And this is the type of PCs that are, you know, became fairly common within the tablet PC world, where the screen could kind of flip around and then latch back on over the keyboard. And then it would look like kind of a slightly thicker slate that you could use with a stylus, right? And then you could unlatch it again and swing it back around. It would just be like a normal laptop.
Right, the convertible.
And everyone thought these were fantastic. And everyone made something like this, everyone who was making tablet PCs. And I think they sold like 13 or 14 of them over the past 7 years.
Yeah, I knew a couple of those 13.
Yeah, I did too, actually. In fact, I still have one. They just never really took off, I think is the point. So now we're going back to the Slate. But I think that, you know, where Apple kind of succeeds and where Microsoft can never succeed is, you know, Apple succeeded in this market, such as it is, sort of reinvented this market by coming out with something that was based on a much simpler OS. And also, and not just a simpler looking OS. I mean, like a simple OS. You know, when Microsoft thought about the tablet PC market a decade or more ago, they decided that they needed to make this complete platform where handwriting recognition had to work, where voice recognition had to work, where you could literally write with a stylus on a pressure-sensitive screen. If you push down harder, it would make a bigger blob, you know, or it would write in bold or whatever, that it would recognize what you were writing, that it would treat it just like text, that it would, you know, it was an amazing sort of system for what it was. Of course, the PCs of the days were far, you know, underpowered to do anything about it, but that was the system they came up with. You know, by comparison, the iPad is like finger painting, isn't it? I mean, it's like comparing a beautiful 3D wireframe model to your kid finger painting on the fridge.
It's a toy. Yeah. That's my opinion of the iPad. Is it's fun, but it's like something from Fisher-Price or Mattel. You know, it does what it does really well, but it's kind of limited in what it does, and it's mostly good for fun things.
Right. You know, taken in isolation, if you presented either one of these products to people and said, which one of these, makes more sense? I think almost anyone would have picked the tablet PC, you know, but it's funny because I think the iPad type design is the one that's really taking off. Now, Microsoft, of course, is going to try again with Windows 7. And this didn't work before. I don't understand what's changed. I mean, yes, PCs are a little more powerful. Tablet PC, you know, the platform today supports multi-touch and touch if you want to do that stuff. I wouldn't say that the Windows OS is necessarily optimized for that kind of thing, but it's there, you know. But, I mean, to me, this is a lot like the last version of Windows Mobile, where it's possible to have this kind of pretty thing on the front of it, but eventually you're going to have to dive into the system. And at some point, you reach the UI where the finger is too big to handle the gadget that you're trying to click on, and it just, you know, it doesn't work. And I just don't understand who this is for. You know, if there's a market of some tens of millions of people a year to buy a very simple tablet, you know, consumption type of device, essentially, okay, fair enough. But like you said, that's kind of a toy. You know, if you're talking about a productivity machine, an actual computer, a screen, you know, without a keyboard, a mouse, that's not it. It's just, nothing has changed. I don't understand why. Why are we talking about this? You know, well, it's crazy.
The other thing that people have told me when I make the toy comment, the people in the medical professions or something like that come back to me and say, well, you know what? It's really good in our industry because it's great for doctors to carry some data around with them in a small form factor and show their patients. And it definitely has those niche uses here and there. But the way you're talking about is productivity.
Yeah. Right. What you just said is classic, because that's exactly the conversation we had over 10 years ago about the tablet PC.
Exactly.
That's exactly the market that is good for. There are people who walk around factory floors. There are people who walk out in the world like, you know, the UPS guy that goes from his truck to the house has something that's sort of like a little iPad-y thing. It uses a pen, actually. But, you know, there are markets where this is okay. Yes, someone who is a child or is for some reason filled with childlike delight might enjoy an iPad, but... I mean, really? I mean,
All these Slate PC rumors now say, well, they're only going to market it to the enterprise. They're not going to go after the consumer market.
That's crazy.
Wait, yeah, where which part of the enterprise do you think the Slate PC is going to take off in?
Right, it doesn't make any sense to me at all. You know, one of the dumbest things I've ever seen, and I know you people are out there, and I'm looking right at you. If I ever see anyone pull an iPad out of a bag, followed by a stand, followed by a keyboard, seriously, get a life. Or are you kidding me? You know, for only three times the price of your average netbook, look how I've optimized my life. You know, it's like you know, this is a little off topic, but it's a Mac. It's kind of Mac instead of PC. But I witnessed a woman explain to the man in front of me that she had bought a 17-inch MacBook Pro because she was tired of her Dell PC crashing, mm-hmm. and she had solved all of her problems. So I said, excuse me, you know, I was behind her on the plane. I said, how much did you spend on that MacBook Pro there? $29.99.
Yep.
I said, do you realize you could have bought four Dell laptops for that much money, kept three of them in a closet, and then every single time it crashed, you could just bring out a new one? I mean, so I'm glad
that she said it's worth it for the frustration of not having to pull the one out of the closet.
But this is the same... If you can say to me, look, I can afford it and I want it because I just am attracted to it, that's a reason, you know. But, I mean, as far as an iPad goes, I, like you, I guess, I just don't quite get it. And I don't say that from the position of someone, I have one and I use it, try to use it. I find it to be frustrating on a number of levels because of the reflection on the screen and, you know, other things like that. I've, as a traveler, have often asked for and never received a Kindle-sized device that would watch movies and get great battery life, but not reflect my face back in it as I was watching it. You know, I've never been able to watch a movie on a plane using an iPad where I could see anything other than my own face clearly.
Well, you're using it wrong, obviously. It's not supposed to be used in areas with light.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I've been able to, I actually like using it on the plane, but you do have to make sure that you've tilted in just the right direction so that you're not seeing yourself and got to unfocus your eyes.
The problem is that direction is always slightly different. And you get into this situation where you're, you know, you're kind of, you're always, you know, just repositioning it. Anyway, I didn't mean this to be an iPad rant. Honestly, the thing I'm more upset about is that the PC industry, Microsoft specifically, is being pulled back into this, you know, into their version of Afghanistan. I mean, what are you kidding me? This has never worked. It's never going to work. I mean, how many times do you need to fail at this before you figure it out?
Never fight a land war in Asia and never put out a Windows-based tablet.
Yes, thank you. That's right.
Principles to live by. Now, you mentioned the Kindle there just a minute ago, and Amazon just announced new super cheap Kindles.
Yes. Now, I've been a Kindle user literally from day one. I bought the first one the first day it came out. I bought every subsequent one, not the DX, but the normal size one, the day they've come out. So,
are you going to buy this one?
I already did. I pre-ordered it.
Question is moot.
Yes. And the reason is simple. I read a lot, and the Kindle has the best reading experience, period. It's not even close. My wife uses my old Kindle now. When the new one arrives, she'll get the Kindle too, and we'll kind of push them down the line like that. But I have always felt very strongly that the Kindle was an incredible device, and that the only thing that was hampering it was the price. And I want to say when it first came out, it was $359 or $379 or whatever the price was.
Right.
And if you go back and look at my original view, the thing I wrote was, it's just fantastic. It's way too expensive.
Yeah, I said the exact same thing. And I bought one, but I said the exact same thing.
Yeah. Now, over time, of course, they've lowered the price a lot. The Kindle 2 that I have is the, like I said, I bought it on day one. So it's actually a little different than the one that's in the market today, because the one that's out today, you can bring internationally and use the 3G internationally. And mine actually doesn't work that way.
And no Wi-Fi either.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. It's no Wi-Fi. So the change in the new one, aside from the, you know, it's a little smaller and it has a higher contrast screen, which is awesome, is that it's Wi-Fi for $139, which I think for, you know, I think that's going to be the best seller by far. Because most people are going to use it at home. You know, they can download books at home. It's no problem. And then the 3G version for $189, which is the current price. And that actually is the one that I got. I would love to be, you know, I'm going to be in Germany. So one of the things that happens when you bring the Kindle, the one I have international, is it doesn't automatically download the newspaper every day. I read the New York Times using the Kindle. And it's a little bit of a hassle because you have to download it to the computer and then sync it to the device. So when I'm in Europe, it's the one time I ever connect it to my computer. I've never, in fact, I got to find the, I do have the cable for that. I never use it like that here. So it's kind of odd. And it would, you know, it would be nice to have one that didn't require that. But
yeah.
It doesn't have color yet. I think that technology is just not there for that kind of screen. And it doesn't have a touch screen, I guess, although I don't consider that to be a huge problem personally.
Everyone tries to touch it, though. I don't know about you. Whenever I show somebody a Kindle for the first time, they always start putting their fingers, and I'm like, hey, stop mucking up my screen there. It's not a touch screen. But everybody wants it to be, and I think that's why you always hear that, is like, oh, but it'd be so nice if it were. The Sony Reader is nice with the touch screen. I've used that a few times, but it does get a little gummy, just like the iPad does.
Yeah, I think the big deal, though, is for the Kindle compared to the Sony stuff is just the library of content that they have. And I don't know how Sony handles periodicals, but I really like the automatic, you know, I wake up every morning and the paper's waiting.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the auto delivery is pretty nice.
Yeah, it's really, really nice. And that's the big thing, you know, and I wanted the iPad, you know, the iPad is a bigger screen, it's color. One thing that a lot of people don't understand is that Kindle books do have color when it's appropriate, if they're photographs. You just don't see them in color on the Kindle. But if you run Kindle software on your PC or Mac, or on an iPod or iPhone, or now on the iPad, those color photos and things do come through and look beautiful. But the problem with the iPad screen is that it's just too reflective. It's not really a good reading experience.
I actually absolutely love the Whisper Sync on Amazon too, because if I've got my phone, I can read it, you know, on the train, and then I can be at work and pull up the, you know, the Amazon app, fire up Windows and read it in the Amazon app.
Sync to your latest read, you know.
Yeah.
Point. It's beautiful. Yeah.
The only time it messes up, every once in a while, I'll accidentally skip somehow forward, like way forward. And then it's screwed for the rest of my reading because you can't reset that point. I want to be able to reset that sync point.
I haven't had too many screw-ups. I mean,
only had that happen once.
Yeah, I have seen it been off a couple pages. I mean, they're not really pages, but once or twice. But not, it's been pretty good. And it's also, you know, this software is available everywhere. It's on the Android phones, iPod Touch, and iPhone, iPad, PC, and Mac, and then of course the dedicated Kindle devices. I mean, it's so well supported across the board. It's really nice.
Well, let's get back to a little more Microsoft-oriented news. The Black Hat conference going on right now, there's Microsoft has kind of come out about their responsible disclosure, and they're doing a security tie-up with Adobe?
Yeah, I don't know if you've talked about this stuff yet. I very rarely have briefings of this type, but I actually talked to these guys in advance, and Microsoft has a program called the Active Protection Program, which is a response to this issue where every month, you know, like you said, reliability, you know, Microsoft, very predictable. Second Tuesday of every month, they have this security, you know, Patch Tuesday. Yeah, and they release all their monthly security patches. Well, the problem was, once you start doing stuff like that, now that the patches come out, people can look at the patches and say, oh, well, look what they're fixing. There's something wrong with the software. And it's very easy to find where the vulnerable software is. And because people don't always patch right away, people can write exploits, put malware out there in the world, and exploit PCs. So there's actually this, there was this phenomenon they called Exploit Wednesday, where, you know, the day after every Patch Tuesday, all of a sudden, there would be these zero-day attacks. So to prevent this, Microsoft started the Microsoft Active Protection Program a few years back. And what they do is, ahead of Patch Tuesday, they report all of their internal information about the patches they're going to give out to security software companies. So they can build the protections into their software solutions ahead of time and have them available for Patch Tuesday, trying to prevent this Exploit Wednesday type of thing.
Yeah, right.
Now, that's fantastic stuff. I mean, it's such a great idea. But, you know, Microsoft, as the makers of the OS primarily, one of the things that they've seen is that as Windows has gotten more secure and as other forms of software, like their certain applications especially, have gotten very popular, hackers are starting to turn to the riper, you know, fruit, which are these applications. So people aren't hacking Windows as much as they used to, but now they're going after applications and, in many cases, third-party applications like those made by Adobe. You know, I think the Adobe vulnerability stuff has gotten a lot of press lately. People are pretty hip to the fact that it's not so much that they're notably bad software makers. It's just that they write incredibly popular software. So hackers are going after it. So Adobe has joined the MAP program. They're the only company beside Microsoft that's going to supply this same type of vulnerability information to security software vendors in advance of Patch Tuesday. I think that Adobe does quarterly releases, I want to say, not monthly. Mm-hmm. But they do come out on that same Tuesday that Microsoft's do. So every quarter, they're going to update the software security vendors with their own vulnerabilities in the same way that Microsoft does. Again, in an attempt to prevent these exploits from happening.
Is this all part of the coordinated disclosure plan that Microsoft is also touting, saying, you know what, we don't want to do the responsible disclosure anymore, where you have to tell us and we don't have to do anything. They're trying to get everybody on the same page and do coordinated releases of vulnerabilities, giving 60 days or something for once something is found.
You know, Microsoft has been bit in the past few months a couple of times by some high-profile releases of information about vulnerabilities that came out before they had a chance to respond to them, right? There was a big zero-day attack on Windows XP that occurred, I think, after a Google researcher somewhere, you know, discussed some kind of a vulnerability. And then this past week, there was one that affects all versions of Windows, right? The shortcut link issue that came out again was these things sort of happened before Microsoft had a chance to even respond, you know.
Well, depending on who you ask, the security researchers say we told them months and months and months ago and we never heard anything and we felt it was irresponsible. There's this big argument going on about who said what when.
Right. So I guess the way I think of this is that to me sounds believable, but I don't feel that it's responsible for anyone to publicly reveal how to exploit Windows if Microsoft hasn't responded either. I mean, it just seems irresponsible to do that. I mean, because this is what happens, you know. Microsoft's trying to be a little more political about it. You know, they're trying to, we're going to talk to everyone. We want to get along with everyone, that kind of stuff. But, I mean, I think there's one of the unsaid thing that's going on this week at Black Hat is like, guys, you got to work with us, you know. And not just work with us, but, you know, take the same kind of responsibility for this stuff that we do. Because, you know, if you know about something and publish information about it, you know, you become part of the problem.
Well, and the researchers are saying, look, but if we don't hear anything and don't hear anything, and then we know that vulnerability is already out there, what are we supposed to do? I think it's a good conversation that's happening where they can work this out. And I don't know that I totally buy the coordinated disclosure system. I think I kind of prefer what Google's talking about, where it's like, look, you let us know, we have to let you know that we heard, and then we've got 60 days to fight it, you know, to come up with something.
Yep.
Because that puts a little bit of the pressure on both sides to do the right thing.
Right. Now, So I don't have any information about whether or not Microsoft ever heard from these people, but I agree 100% that they need to respond. Absolutely, yeah.
Now, Microsoft getting upset by Google over the Yahoo partnership in Japan. Yahoo Japan, if people don't know, is not owned entirely by Yahoo. In fact, Yahoo's a minority partner. Yeah. SoftBank is the majority partner. And Yahoo Japan has decided to go with Google, whereas Yahoo here in the U.S. is partnering with Bing. So Microsoft's nose has been out of shape, right?
Yeah, except that it's actually a little more complicated than that because, I mean, that, you know, on the surface of things, that's what it looked like. And it's, you know, of course they would be upset about that. But actually, it's kind of an antitrust concern because in Japan, Google owns over 50% of the market for internet search and Yahoo owns almost 50% of the market. So if those two companies combine together,
boom,
they will own almost 100% of the market. And it's not just, you know, market ownership, you know, pure monopoly. The issue is the way that search results get improved over time is by having some volume of search data to work with. And if everyone is going through one single engine, there is no competitor that could come up and possibly compete effectively because they just wouldn't have the range of search results in Japan that could help them do that, you know. And, you know, Microsoft points to the U.S. Department of Justice action against Google when they tried to align with Yahoo before Yahoo teamed up with Microsoft in 2008. They found that agreement to be illegal, and that agreement was not nearly as far-reaching as the one that Google and Yahoo are trying to do in Japan. So it actually has some interesting antitrust angles to it as well. So you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, according to Google, the I think it was the Japanese FTC already okayed this deal, I think. I think that's what they said.
What would be the justification for that if you're talking about 99.9% of the market being in one company? I don't see how you allow that.
Right. But we live in the United States. So,
you know, exactly.
We have a different perspective.
Our toilets are much simpler here, too.
Yeah, exactly. So, our toilets don't talk to us. I mean, I agree with that 100%. I don't think they should be able to control the market in that way, especially not through a simple, you know, sign and carry kind of deal. But, you know, that is potentially what could be happening in Japan. So I guess we'll see.
All right. Well, let's take a moment to thank another one of our sponsors, Squarespace.com. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the fast and easy way to publish a high quality website or blog. You get a free trial and 10% off your new account just for watching Paul and I talk about Windows. What more could you ask for? Squarespace.com/Windows is the place where you want to go, and you get 10% off your new account. So check it out. Squarespace is easy to use. You don't have to know anything about CSS or HTML, although if you do, you can play around with the code as well and still use their templates. It's kind of the best of both worlds. So if you know enough to be dangerous, you can go in there, try some things, look at the code, maybe even learn something, and you get an easy-to-use UI as well. So, you know, import your blog for free. Give it the free trial. You can take it from TypePad or WordPress or anything else. And then go get the 10% off if you decide to keep it at squarespace.com/windows. No credit card needed. You just try it out, build out your website, see if you like it. Well, it would be Windows 7 feature of the week and Windows 7 tip of the week, but they went to Detroit with Leo, I guess. Right?
No, they went to Germany.
Oh, they're off to Germany. You're going to Germany.
I'll still do them on the web. I won't ignore them online, but I just didn't have time to prepare them for the show. So.
No worries. Well, I thought you came up with a pretty good substitute, which is to do a little live Q&A with the chat room. Mm-hmm. So give them a little lead time here. If you've got a question, throw it in the chat room right now. And you want me to just moderate?
If you don't mind. I don't have any
That's
way to do it.
That's easy. So you got a question you want to throw at Paul or at me, but throw them at Paul. I'm tired. Yeah, just put it in the chat room and let us know. Okay, we got one from Jimmy here to start us up. Microsoft has talked a lot about three screens and the cloud. When will this vision really start kicking off?
Yeah, so it's always been more promise than reality, obviously. But actually, I would say Windows Phone and a combination of some interesting Windows Live services are what's going to make this sort of a reality. And I think the closest you're going to see to it is actually some of the game stuff that's occurring in Windows Phone. You know, using this XNA Studio, right away, it's going to be very possible to write, especially turn-based games, but any type of game, using the same code, essentially, that will run on the phone, run on Windows PCs, and eventually will run on the Xbox 360 as well. And I think there's been some hyperbole around that. I don't think there's going to be a huge scenario where you're sitting at your computer before you leave for work in the morning playing some action 3D game, and then you pause it, hop on the bus, and continue playing it on the phone. I don't think it's going to work quite like that. But, you know, I think it's going to be more along the lines of turn-based games in the beginning. But what we're really talking about behind the scenes are all the services, and the services working across all of these screens. Services like Zune, the Zune Marketplace, and the Zune Pass, you know, the subscription. Yeah, the Zune movie and TV purchasing and renting capabilities. The Xbox Live gaming stuff that I just mentioned. Windows Live services, email, calendar, contacts, and so forth, all working behind the scenes. Windows Live Photos, you know, coming on down onto the phone and eventually down onto your Xbox 360, that kind of stuff. So it's kind of happening in a piecemeal way, but it is happening. And I would say, you know, just maybe 3-4, you know, 6 months down the road, it will be less vision and more reality than it is right now, but it's definitely getting there. And, you know, some of the stuff to look out for would be Windows Phone, obviously, happening. Some of the XNA stuff that's coming down the road. The expansion of the Zune music service onto the Xbox 360 is a great way to get that content out to the your HDTV, your home theater, not just the video stuff, which is actually already pretty incredible, but also the music stuff. So I think it's happening, but it's just, you know, Microsoft is a way of talking things up, you know, before before it's there. So
yeah, I'm looking forward to that that Xbox thing. If I were to get a hold of a Windows phone and be able to pick up a game where I left off, that'd be pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. I like that a lot.
It's possible, you know. We'll see how that works. I mean, I've been investigating the game stuff for the book, and there are interesting layers of possibilities. You know, not all of Xbox Live is coming down to the phone, but I think the key pieces are, and it's a little, from a developer perspective, if you want to be part of Xbox Live, it's a little more complicated than if you just want to make a game, you know, that works on the phone. Anyone could make a game that works on the phone, but if you want to be part of Xbox Live, you have to meet certain criteria, obviously. And but that's where those capabilities are going to get exposed. And I think it's, yeah, it's pretty exciting. But, you know, day one, when Windows Phone ships, I mean, maybe not so much, you know, 6 months down the road, I think we'll finally see some of that stuff happening.
Slightly related, Little Hamlet wants to know, will Phone 7 have any kind of DirectX use?
DirectX use?
Yeah.
Beyond gaming? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I guess he's just wondering if there'll be some for gaming. Is that already there?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, there's, I don't know if it's DirectX, what level of DirectX we're at, but I mean, the gaming libraries that are available for Windows Phone take advantage of GPU that's going to be present in all the phones. And like I said, you know, use the same gaming libraries. So you may not see too many examples of, I'm trying to think of a game, like a modern Call of Duty shooter isn't going to be the same exact code across all of the game types, you know, the Windows, the Xbox, and the phone, but the framework will be the same, and you can port the game engine between those different devices very easily. And actually, that's a huge advantage for the Microsoft stack in general, I think for Windows Phone, you know, specifically as well.
Yeah, a few people are actually asking what manufacturers have signed up for the Windows Phone. I actually haven't seen many lists about that. Is that information out there?
Yeah, off the top of my head, you'd have to go back to, if you go back to the February announcement, Microsoft had a bunch of names up on the board, and basically it's exactly the same, except HP isn't on there anymore. HP, of course, bought Palm and WebOS, so they're not doing it. We know that Dell, HTC, LG, Samsung are all on board. And then there are, you know, rumors of other companies. You know, Nokia even has been rumored to get in there, Sony and others. So we'll see.
We also have the inevitable, when will Windows 8 come out?
I know exactly when it's going to come out, so that's no problem.
Of course you do.
We
have started to hear little bits of what do we know about Windows 8? Is there anything important, or is it just way too early still?
There's nothing that we know about it other than the proposed schedule, which is 2 years from right now, mid 2012.
All right.
1 year from right now, we will have some kind of a PDC where we have a limited private beta, like we did at PDC 2009 PDC 2008 for Windows 7. Sometime in the 6 months following that, there'll be a public beta. And then sometime by the middle of 2012, you're going to see the final release.
Dr. Mom was asking for a good replacement for the software removal tool.
Oh, this is the Microsoft tool. You know, yeah. You can actually still... All right, so I haven't investigated this thoroughly yet. You can actually still get it. It's on, I think it's Softpedia, for example, still has it.
So you can just download it and put it in.
Yeah, the reason it's not on Microsoft.com anymore is that it was always designed to only target specific versions of the Microsoft installer. And I think what has happened is that the Microsoft installer has been updated and it doesn't work consistently across the different versions. So it's always been kind of a limited use thing. And I haven't gotten an official word back from Microsoft. Somebody asked me, it might even be the same person, had asked me about this via email. So I actually did get in a query about that, but I haven't heard back. My guess would be either that they're just not doing it anymore because it was kind of random what it worked with and what it didn't in the beginning, or that they're going to be updating it to take advantage of some of the, you know, the newer versions of the installer. So I think it's just in kind of a hiatus right now.
Area 52 was actually among a few people who were wondering if the canceling of the Kin phone would cool the market for Windows Phone 7. I don't really think so, but is there anything to that? You know, do they suffer any blowback from that?
No, I mean, this is another example of, you know, people like us who understand that these things were related in some way, and it's like, oh, well, you know, what does this mean? To the wider consumer base, I mean, let's face it, nobody even heard of the Kin. Of the people who did hear about the Kin or knew anything about it, none of them knew that it had anything to do with Windows Phone. I mean, I don't think so. But, you know, you could look at it from a glass half full perspective, which I don't actually do very often, but just to throw this out on. You know, Microsoft, by getting rid of the Kin like they did in such a decisive fashion, in many ways is sending a message that they're very serious about Windows Phone, right? That they, too, understood that having different, slightly different things that weren't quite the same, but sort of had the same name and were sort of on the same platform, maybe wasn't the best strategy. And that by throwing all of their weight behind Windows Phone, that they're signaling to the industry and to customers that this is what we are very serious about. So I guess you could look at it from that perspective. The Kin phone was a vendor-specific solution, whereas Windows Phone is going to be marketed all around the world, through every wireless vendor, through numerous phone makers. It's a completely different situation. So, and I would also throw, you know, the Zune HD. A lot of people say, well, you know, what's it going to be like Zune HD, where it's super unpopular because they only sell it in one place, but it's still an excellent software solution. How come no one knows? I don't think so, because, you know, the Zune HD is basically only sold here in the U.S., but these Windows Phone devices are going to be everywhere.
And another topic that seems to be on people's mind a lot is Windows Home Server. Do we have any news about that or about Veil? So a lot of people are saying, should I wait? Should I hold off?
Right. This is a tough one. And again, you have to kind of fall down on party lines here. Windows Home Server is going to be updated this year to a brand new version. If you have a Windows Home Server solution that was a pre-made, you know, HP box is the big one here in the United States. It's the one I have. You're not going to be able to grade that thing to Veil. It's just not going to work. Even if the server maker were to come out with some form of upgrade package, such as it was, you would have to wipe out the server, reinstall the OS from scratch, get your data back, that kind of thing. It's not going to be pretty. That said, Windows Home Server is really kind of an appliance when you think about it. It's not, you know, when you buy a DVD player, you don't expect to upgrade it to the newest version of the firmware. I mean, some people maybe do, but I mean, I think the way people think, you know, it's a device. It's like an appliance. You know, your toaster isn't upgraded to new forms of toasting. You know, you buy a new one, you know, that kind of thing. And I think that these appliances work like that. There's nothing about the release of Veil that means your existing home server isn't going to, you know, not work, you know, isn't going to stop working or whatever. It doesn't change anything. In fact, this month, there are actually going to be some new releases of home server products based on the existing code base, you know, that, by the way, dates back to Windows Server 2003. You know, from the perspective of a power user, it's a little disillusioning in some ways. But you got to remember, to most people, these are just solutions that do a certain thing, and they still work really, really well. So if you built your own home server, you're free, of course, to, you know, just install the new software from scratch. But again, you're going to have to go through that process of getting all your data back. There's no seamless version-to-version migration or upgrade path. So that's going to be the sticky part of it. But again, I would just remind people, it's not really designed for that. It's an appliance.
All right. Shall we take one more?
Sure.
We got one person who's very persistent, wanting to know if you like the direction IE9 is taking. That's a virtual me asking that question. A little vague.
Yeah. It's early to say. I mean, I've been a little... One of the things I've communicated to Microsoft many times about IE9 is that they're talking about very low-level stuff, and they're moving very methodically, which they like to do. I feel like the wider world and the browser world, especially in this case, is moving very quickly, and that they need to move quickly, more quickly, you know, than they are. I think from an end-user perspective, there are some... things at Microsoft I probably learned with IE8, which is that these end user features that were in many ways were very innovative and interesting, didn't really take off in the marketplace. Nobody uses web slices or accelerators or, you know, these other features. They're just not, you know, broadly important. The things that are broadly important to people, I think, are this is weird to even say this, but are things like HTML5 and hardware accelerated video playback, I think, is going to be huge for people. So I think from that perspective, they're targeting the right stuff. But I wish they would move more quickly, you know. In some ways, I wish what they did was simply release the rendering engine for IE8, you know. I wish they could just somehow... They're so tied to the Windows release cycle that I feel like they're constrained in some ways from moving very quickly. And, of course, they're Microsoft, so they also have backwards compatibility issues for their corporate customers and, you know, these concerns that... other companies don't really have. But I think it's smart to target standards, and I think it's smart to target the specific standards that they're targeting. So
what's it going to take to kill IE6 off? Because when you talk about corporate, you know, concerns, I mean, that's the one thing that is keeping that thing on life support. It needs to go.
Right. So this is a tough one. I don't want to drag this
That's up. My question, by the way. It didn't come from the chat room.
It's tied to XP, right? Microsoft's inability to kill off XP is what's going to keep IE6 around for a long, long time, even though it's finally starting to dwindle off. The rationale for this is very simple. You can talk all you want about support life cycles, and, you know, we're not going to deliver patches after this, you know, point, and yada, yada, yada. But if XP were completely out of support right now, and some hacker targeted Windows XP and literally exploited hundreds of millions of computers, how could Microsoft not be responsible enough to respond to that and do something about it? So they can talk all they want about not wanting to support that thing, but the truth is, when you have hundreds of millions of people using it, you can't ignore it. Now, I'm not really sure how many people are using IE6, but I bet it is potentially 100 million people or more. I mean, it's probably a lot of people. So IE6 will never disappear if Microsoft continues to support it. It's kind of a chicken and the egg thing. I mean, they have to, because it would be irresponsible not to. It would be maybe even corporate suicide, because some of their biggest enterprise customers are probably still on IE6. But it creates a weird situation. You know, they're already working on the third, you know, upgrade since IE6. But, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, they can't say no if it's that many people. It's a tough situation to be in.
Yeah, I've heard Microsoft coming out with cajoling people to get off IE6. Like they've
done everything.
You know, there's just very little they can do.
I'm waiting for the rebate check. You know, send us your uninstall screen from IE6, and we'll send you $50. Like seriously, you know, you don't even have to use IE something. Just stop using IE6. That's right. All we're asking.
Everybody's going to go to oldapps.com and download it so they can get the $20 check.
Exactly. And run it on like a Windows 98 VM or something.
All right, time for our Audible pick of the week. This episode is brought to you by audible.com, the leading provider of audiobooks with over 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction and nonfiction. And a lot of people forget they have periodicals as well. For listeners of Windows Weekly, Audible offers a free audiobook. And you got one you wanted to recommend, right, Paul?
No, actually, I don't.
No?
But I do have one that my wife wants to recommend.
Oh, okay, good. So I scared me there. I was about to do a quick search.
Backpedal quickly, yeah. You'll be like, oh, really? You don't? Let's see what we have here.
Well, in that case, The sword and
no,
laser.
You know, it's funny. I just spent many hours loading up my various iPods and Zunes and my Windows phone. Actually, not my Windows phone. Various devices here with some Audible stuff. And I actually toyed. I was talking to my wife about this, and I said, you know, I kind of want to go back to one of the classics. I have some books that I haven't recommended, but you know, have been in the collection for a long, long time. And she says, no, you got to recommend this thing. And she gave me this, you know, I guess it's a big deal right now, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest by Stieg Larsson. If I'm not mistaken, this is the author. He wrote maybe three books, and
yeah,
he passed away, and now they're...
The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is the most famous one, because the movie and all that. So I think this I don't know if this is second or third, but this is in that. Yeah,
she's reading these books, and she described, this is how she described it, as a literary crime fiction that... She said a lot of crime fiction leaves women out of it, and that this one was not unfriendly to women. So I said, "Well, is it like a chick lit kind of a book, or like a this isn't like a book for women, is it?" And she said, "No, it's for everybody.
It's not a gothic romance, in other words."
Yes, yeah. I said, "Well, okay." So I have to give you the caveat that this is from my wife, and if I'm not mistaken, whatever the first book is in the series, I think that Daniel Craig, the guy who is James Bond now, has agreed to star in the movie.
Ah, very nice. Well, and I know Leo's reading The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is the first
book. That's the first one. Is that a movie now? Or is that a movie?
It is being made into a movie, yeah. Okay. Is it out? I can't remember if it actually came out.
I don't know.
Thank goodness this isn't Frame Rate, the other show I do about movies. I'd be more embarrassed.
I want to say Daniel Craig is associated with a movie based on one of these books.
The Swedish version is out, is what everyone in the chat room is saying. English version is coming next year. So maybe Daniel Craig's going to be in the English version.
If you're looking for more traditional Swedish crime fiction, I mean, who wouldn't be? There is, of course, the Wallander series, which is, I don't know if that's on Audible, but that's a possibility.
All right. Well, if you would like to try out The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, if you've already read, if you're at the right point in the series, or you want to try The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, you can get it for free. You download an audiobook for free by going to audiblepodcast.com. Or actually, for us, it's audible.com/windows. And you'll be able to cash in and get that book for free and try out Audible. And I'm actually reading the Robert Heinlein book, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, on Audible right now. And it's a good one to read because when you read it in text form, it's kind of tough because it needs to be read in a Russian accent. And you might not catch on to that right away. But if you're doing the Audible version, it's in a Russian accent right from the beginning. It all makes sense. All right, let's get to our software pick of the week. What do you got for us?
So I have two. And they couldn't be more different.
Software picks of the week, then.
The first one is Steam, and this is just the
PC Steam
game engine, you know?
Yeah.
I was loading up my laptop, actually. You know, we're going to Germany, so I'm going to be uprooting myself out of my office is difficult, you know? So I'm trying to get as much stuff on my laptop and laptops as I can. So one of the things I did was I installed a bunch of my Steam games, but I noticed going to their site, they have a bunch of... In fact, they have over 600 games that cost under $10. So there's some surprisingly inexpensive stuff in there. Definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, they did a sale on Portal. Have you played? They did. I snapped that up, even though I had the console version, because like I wanted to be able to play it on my PC.
Yeah, Portal's classic. In fact, there's a new Portal version coming out this holiday season, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's right. I know Jonathan Colton is working with them a little bit on the music. And it's going to be picking up where we left off. It's sort of an exploded version of everything. I can't wait for it.
Yeah, the song at the end of the original Portal is absolutely classic. The second pick I have is something I don't remember how I ran into this week, but Google Chrome has always had, you know, their normal build tree, the normal product, you know, the public version. They've had like a developer tree. And now they have this, what they call canary builds. It has kind of a funny yellow icon. The difference between this and the other versions of Chrome is that you can actually run this side by side. So if you want to have like a stable, normal version of Chrome plus something with all of the very latest features and the new UI and all the changes they're making, you can run this so-called canary build side by side with your existing Chrome version, which is a great reason to do it. And I wish you can't actually set it as your default browser, which is too bad. I would do that. I kind of like playing around with the latest stuff. So if you're looking for the very latest version of the browser that right now is moving along the fastest, there's a new way to do that. And that's the Google Chrome Canary build.
Yeah, it's tools.google.com/dlpage/chrome-sxs. Is that for side-by-side, you think?
Side, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the idea of being able... Now, will that update automatically with the new builds, or do you have to re-download it every time?
I just... You know, that's a good point. Let me check.
Because that would make it for me if I was able to just have it always give me the latest experimental so I could play around. If something goes wrong with that, I just go over and boot regular Chrome.
I just installed this yesterday, and it's up to date, and so I don't know how it does it. You know, in Firefox, sometimes you'll turn it on. It will say, hey, you got a new... You know, do you want to install the new build? I assume it works like that. I actually don't know yet. So
yeah, well, that's a cool one anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Paul, thanks for being fantastically easy to host a show with.
Okay. I don't know what that means, but you're welcome. And thank you as well for being a credible Leo.
I can never be Leo, but at least I can fill in from time to time.
No, but there is, you know, there is a skill to the segue. You know, and you apparently have mastered that.
Thank you very much. Leo, of course, is out at Maker Faire in Detroit. He's going to do a fan meetup on July 30th. That's tomorrow at 7 p.m. Eastern time. So if you're in Detroit, you want to head to the Hyatt Regency, the Archimedes Lounge, 600 Town Center in Dearborn, Michigan, and meet Leo. Hang out with a bunch of other folks who watch Twit, talk tech. He's going to be at Maker Faire the next day on Saturday. We're going to be streaming live from that. And so you're going to want to see that as well. I think that starts at 11 a.m. Eastern time, so about 8 a.m. here on the Pacific Coast. He'll do a couple hours for Maker Faire. That's going to be fun, just watching him go around. So anyway, thanks to Ford for making that happen and for also sponsoring Windows Weekly. Paul, anything else before we wrap it up?
No, but, you know, I'm thinking we should do a little Q&A segment every episode, you know. I don't know why we don't do that more often.
Yeah, people in the chat room.
You and I mean, but we collectively.
I'll just come in just for the Q&A segment.
Yeah, I want it to always be you.
Yeah, right. So,
what are you doing on Thursdays?
Right, right. No, people in the chat room really dug it. And there were a couple of people saying, hey, we'd like to have this more often. There are definitely more questions than.
I don't know why we don't do it. Yeah. So maybe I'll try to make this more of a regular thing.
A recurring segment. All right, folks. Thanks for watching. That's it for Windows Weekly. We'll see you next week.